lifespan of a politician is a little bit different than the lifespan of many other individuals that serve on committees. The Senate organization, of course, is yet to be determined. There's some serious discussions going on. In our minds, we feel that the organization has been established. What is going to transpire as far as the elected officials on this panel is concerned is that Representative Sun will now be the co-chair of this joint committee. And in Representative Sun's place will be Representative-elect Kay Brown, and along with Representative Martin. During the November, I think most of you realized why we could not meet, and we'd hoped that things might be a little bit more settled in relation with the other body. But we are going to conduct our hearings today, or our discussions today. At this time, I'll turn over the meeting to the chairman, Representative Sun.
Thank you. I think the first thing we ought to do is approve the minutes from the last meeting, and everybody should have had that in their packet. It's in the back of mine. It's been moved that we approve the minutes from the meeting of September 11th, 1986. Is there any discussion or changes, George?
I just had a few minor corrections that we found on page 2 in the fourth paragraph. They were talking about two main methods used by various states to calculate severance taxes, the classic per unit method and then the percentage of value method. We believe that what Mr. Mockman stated in the minutes didn't reflect was that virtually all resource states use a percentage of value method. It's a minor thing, but it's not brought out in that manner, and that was a point that we would raise to maybe just reflect what he what the true case was there. And then also on page 3 in the paragraph of Dick Mockman about halfway down, a sentence starts out and says, as the price of oil goes down, the elf also goes down. And we feel like it shouldn't say also goes down. It should say the elf can go down, because it doesn't necessarily always go down. And then one other minor thing on page 9, I think at the top of the page it said George Nelson referred to a letter on the subject of expediting collection of disputed taxes, and the minutes say Bruce Kenny, and I think it's Bruce Botello's letter.
Mr. Chairman, with the motion amended as
Mr. Chairman, discussion. Normally when you're doing a correction of minutes, in particular if it's a statement by another person other than the person that is asking for that correction, we should consult with that person that made those remarks, if not simply note the concern of the member objecting.
I have no problem with the note rather than taking the time to consult with them if that was perfect.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, that indeed is what they said and what they meant, and that is something for later discussion.
Okay. With the notes made in the minutes, and we'll check with Dick on that, but I'm sure on whether the elk goes down or can go down, we'll have the experts here in a couple of minutes to talk about that again. So,
like I said, it's not that, you know, big a deal to have it if we reflect it the other way, but I do think Mr. Botello would like his name correct rather than since he wrote the letter.
Okay. Is there any other comments on the minutes? If not, they'll stand approved as noted. The just to outline what we're going to go through today, just the purpose was to set up this morning to go back through some of the ELF factors and some of the options that are available, whether they're good options, bad options, whatever, so we get a clear idea of what presentation is there. This afternoon to spend on going over the state and corporate and individual income taxes, and then come back tomorrow morning was, the idea was to finish up reviewing the other tax issues we have, and then take tomorrow afternoon to have any discussion and action by the committee. At least I think we should have actions. We should come out with a recommendation to the staff to put some kind of preliminary report together of what we've accomplished from the time we've organized till now that we can present to the legislature in the middle to end of January. So with that direction in mind, we'll get all of the ELF and PELS and exponent questions out of the way this morning. I guess, Deborah, are you and Chuck going to join us here?
Chuck has a presentation. Yeah, I can.
Okay. I did remember what an exponent is from the last time we discussed this, so we can proceed from there.
My name is Charles Logston. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have here a subsequent modification in the analysis that you find in your packet. We have, subsequent to preparing this initial analysis of ELF alternatives, done a new forecast, which we do quarterly, so I thought it might be appropriate to at least update the numbers for a number of things that have occurred since the last time I did prepare the analysis. Mainly, we've got new assumptions. We've modified our assumptions somewhat on what we think primary and the initial water flood production from Prudhoe Bay is going to be, and we've also had a change in the federal tax rate, which affects not only the feasibility of additional, the attractiveness of additional capital investment on the North Slope, and also directly impacts the TAPS tariff. Well, let me start by maybe providing a little bit of context for why I think I'm here and what I'm doing. As you know, the ELF has become an issue of some interest over the last year, and in fact there was legislation introduced last session, HB 545, which proposes to modify the ELF. The rationale behind that is that as the current law reads, the tax rate on Prudhoe Bay, because of the way the ELF interacts with the tax rate on that oil field, will decrease beginning roughly July 1 of 1987. The other issue that brought the ELF back into the limelight was the price crash which occurred last spring, in which the issue of the sensitivity of ELF to price came to the forefront when people realized that as the law is currently written, we really didn't have a floor tax, that in fact the 80 cents per barrel floor is not necessarily a floor, because it is possible for the price to go so low that the economic limit factor would impact the tax floor as well as the percent of value tax. So let's look at some of the alternatives that we evaluated to deal with the ELF, should it be determined by the governor or the legislature, whatever, that it is something that needs to be addressed. Okay, there are a lot of alternatives for modifying the ELF. It's a formula, and of course, as any formula, there are as many ways of modifying it as you can sit down and dream up, especially this formula, where you have an exponent, you have a fraction, you can play with the numerators of both the base and the denominator. You can also modify the numerator and the denominator of the exponent, and there are a lot of levers that can be pulled. You can also simplify it. In fact, I'm not going to discuss too many of these alternatives, but I think the presentation by Mr. Erickson at your last meeting, he attempted at any rate to indicate just exactly how these levers could be pulled and what the effect on the ELF would be. Well, let me just say that we looked at four alternatives alternative changes in the ELF and the way in which the ELF applies. And the rationale is as follows. We looked at the possibility of retaining the current 80 cent a barrel floor, but decoupling the ELF from that floor. In other words, making the floor a fixed floor. The floor of 80 cents a barrel would not be subject to the ELF. This is essentially one of the points I think that Dick Monkman raised at the initial or at the hearing last September. This I guess would be in response to the price crash scenario. The other alternative we looked at was the one proposed in HB 545, which subsequently was modified somewhat to by OMB and was presented last time by Dr. Tom Chester. The third alternative we evaluated was that to adjust the floor for inflation. The 80 cents per barrel floor was established, I believe, in 1977 or somewhere around that time, and there has been no adjustment for inflation. So the idea would be to bring that floor into current dollars and then index it so that it would retain its real dollar value over time. And of course, finally, simply because it would be the ultimate modification of ELF, we looked at eliminating the factor entirely. Okay, now the method that we used for evaluating these alternatives was to use the same model that we forecast severance taxes with for official state forecasts. It's a Monte Carlo simulation model. It was used in this analysis for two main reasons. One is that it would be convenient, I think, to use that model so that when we give you some numbers, we can say that this is how much revenues would have changed if we had forecast revenues using the same assumptions but changing the way ELF worked. The second reason we used it is that this modeling technique allows us to, because of the way the model is constructed, to make our own guess as to the effect on the tax base of changing the taxes. And in this case, although we sometimes hesitate to use the term, it would, generally speaking, raise the taxes. Okay. Now, obviously, there are a lot of caveats about whether or not this model is the true answer to anything. It's obviously only as good as the input that's put into it. And in fact, there are a myriad of parameters that that we have to put our own estimates, cost parameters, discount rates, transportation costs, inflation rates, and the like. So I would hesitate to say that this is that any of the results of our investigation are the final answer. But I think it does provide a framework for evaluating the relative impacts of the different alternatives that were considered in terms of changing the law from what it is today. Okay, without any further discussion, let's look at what I'll do is, I know you probably haven't had time to look at these results, so what I'll do is just briefly go over each of the alternatives. The first alternative was to eliminate the application of the ELF to the cents per barrel tax. This would essentially guarantee the state a minimum severance tax payment for every barrel of oil produced in the state, which is currently set at 80 cents per barrel. This would result in our, using our model, in an increase in expected severance tax revenues between 1987 and the year 2005 of $135.4 million nominal dollars, or if you want to get an idea of what that would be in a discounted value, $95.98 million, or a roughly $100 million discounted 8%. That increase in revenue is at the expense over this time period of approximately an average expected production of 19 million barrels of oil. One way of looking at this would be simply to take the amount of revenue gained, divide it by the number of barrels lost, and that would give you a value of about $7 a barrel. So for every dollar of oil you give up, you get $7 a barrel.
Okay.
When you mention an increase on an average, you mean average per year or for that whole period up to the year 2005?
It would be the whole period. So if you would look at
15 years into that.
Yeah, if you wanted to look for the yearly numbers, they're contained in Table 2, which is two pages beyond. And it's you pick up money early on and lose it later on, and mostly because of the effect of the minor effect of the floor on enhanced recovery. Well, let me go on to the...
I said this because a lot of times public reports come out that the state is losing $180 million, the state is using $50 million. And they never clear it up in the news articles that that's over a 15-year period. That tells people, hey, man, divide 15 into that. So a lot of people, the average news reporter really is what it is. It's not that the facts are wrong. They have to be detailed to them.
Right. In other words, yes, let me just expand a little bit on this option. Obviously, by fixing the floor, what we're really doing is setting a minimum revenue that we would realize for our oil. Now, in our model, we evaluate high prices, low prices, a lot of different prices. What this means is that this particular alternative is pretty, I would call it pretty close to revenue neutral. I mean, this is not a lot of addition. This does not affect your on average expectation over the next 20 years of increased revenue by very much. Mostly because it doesn't increase the state's share of any increased value of that oil. If the price goes up very high, there's no difference between the law now and if we had a fixed floor. So this option is fairly revenue neutral on it, and it does have a slight negative impact on production, simply because there are going to be some low price cases where a fixed 80 cents a barrel might make the difference between going for an extra barrel of oil on the slope and not if you were a financially prudent investor. Okay, well, we can get back to any of these things.
What would be the minimum level of oil pricing before fixing the floor at 80 cents would come into effect?
We really haven't calculated. I don't have that number right with me right now. It would it depends on whether we, in a certain sense, it would depend. In our model, there are two things we look at, really. One is the decision to stop producing or continue producing. That's a little bit different decision than do we go ahead and invest to start a new field. For instance, the economics of deciding to shut down Milne Point when it's already in production are different than the economics of deciding to spend a whole bunch of money to develop a new field. That number isn't really solid. I could tell you the hurdle rate, or shall I say the price of oil that is the break even for startup for some of the fields up on the North Slope. We also have a number which we think reflects the shutdown point, but we can pursue this. I would like to have some time to prepare those rather than attempt to give you a number at this time. But
recalled reading this in this handout that we had getting ready for this meeting, that there were various, quote, hurdle rates or pricing numbers for each field. I don't have my finger on it right now, but I can, in here somewhere, but I'm just trying to get a...
Right. I believe at the last committee meeting, I said something like a dollar a barrel was what you needed to keep Prudhoe Bay in operation. But that was that's strictly I would not be prepared to defend that number or any number really, because it's a very complicated decision. I can say that I would we're kind of verging on the edge of some confidentiality problems as far as cost data. But like I say, if you wanted to pursue this, I would be more comfortable if we could. We could probably put together some numbers for the committee, but I don't really have them at this time.
We came close this year.
Right.
Is that accurate?
I would say for some fields on the North Slope, okay, the price situation is devastating. Let me move on to the modified ELF exponent. Essentially, the exponent modification that is present in the current House Bill 545. The formula when.
I have one more question on the 80 cents. What's the relative floor in other states? Do they have a cents per barrel floor in, say, California or Texas or other? And if so, what is that number?
The Department of Revenue does have that. I don't have that with me today. I was not prepared to come up with that. But that is a number that we can provide.
Are we in the ball game? I mean, is ours
relatively high, if I'm not mistaken. But the thing is that many of these other states have no one's severance tax is that I know of, except perhaps Texas, which I think is a strict 6% of value or 5%. A lot of states have fairly, what they have is they don't have a single rate. They would have like a different cents per barrel rate depending on either field production or sometimes they have a combination of cents per barrel and value. So we do have, the Department of Revenue has prepared a comparative severance tax paper. I'd like to provide you a
good suggestion. I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, just for discussion, some of the other states probably have other tax devices where in Alaska we may have to have it high in relation with the floor, where they could probably pick it up in corporate taxes or some other areas. Well, we're talking severance tax. Ours has to be high because we don't have the processing, the distilling, and the other things that go along with it that have added value that can be taxed.
Yeah, as a floor percentage of value, I think Montana probably has the largest severance tax. It's not levied on oil, it's levied on coal. And, but anyway, that's a real apples and oranges comparison. But
okay.
Thanks.
Nelson.
Several things. One, you said, I believe, that we came very close this year on the ELF. The major field is Prudhoe Bay. That's the main revenue source for both the industry as well as the state. We didn't come close because by law we couldn't do anything to change anything until July of 1987. Next, the state of Alaska does have, as far as oil industry taxes are concerned, the highest in the United States, Alaska, and Hawaii. Sure would like to find one in Hawaii, but anyway. In reference to some of the other things, where some of the other states have additional sources of revenue, they also, in looking at the total wide-based spectrum of the tax base for revenue for that state, they also do things that the state of Alaska does not do, which is have either a personal income tax or a sales tax or both. For instance, Texas, we'll use that since it's the largest oil producing state currently. They don't have a personal individual income tax. They do have a sales tax, though, in the state of Texas. And so therefore they do have an additional area. All I'm trying to point out is that they're, you know, and as we were trying to do here within the committee is to look at the whole broad base of what we have available for revenue. So there is other things that play into the other states of having additional revenue just besides a severance tax or a royalty or so on and so forth.
I think this is a good point, and it probably, what it suggests to me is that you want to be real careful about comparing Alaska's severance tax with other states' severance taxes. Just to give you an example of how, you know, I mean, another example, only kind of the other way, is that Texas produces slightly more oil than Alaska. Their severance tax is about a third, and yet they collect more than we do with ours, and that's because the value of the oil is higher, so their tax base is much higher. So as you can, I think we have to look at Alaska as a separate case, and we have to. I mean, I'm not a policymaker, obviously, but I think it makes some sense to view any comparative severance tax. You know, how do we stack up a severance tax? You probably would want to look at the whole gamut rather than just, but we will provide the information about the cents per barrel floor.
With respect to that comment, I can agree that they may look at the severance tax separately, but I think we should not get into a tunnel where we don't also understand these other places may have lower severance taxes, they may have lower some of this other, which affects their state, but we have the royalty also, but the point I'm trying to make is that we in the industry have a certain amount of money to invest and to reinvest in places, and you know, we're going to try to look at each case. We will look at each thing, an individual project on a case-by-case basis. And so naturally, part of it is going to be where we think the potential is, but also then that potential, if the project's not going to be economic because of other things that are added into it, taxes being one of them that we have to feed into the equation, then it is going to make a difference as to where the industry will be able to economically invest their money and reinvest the money. So severance tax will play a part in that. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I look at it from a broad perspective too. I mean, I think the basis of, if I can recall correctly, when we got into what is the fair share of Alaska's return off of oil, I think Governor Hammond put it, said, well, our fair share is somewhere in the 28% to 30% range, and I guess I'm not sure where we are in that perspective right now. Out of the total value of the oil coming out, what is the state getting through all of its taxing means? And obviously, I don't know if that's changed up or down with the decrease of the price of oil. The feds are probably getting less now because they're not getting the windfall profits. But yeah, it's all one big pot. But I'm not afraid to look at other states. I think I can sort apples from oranges as well as the next guy. So
sure.
Smart.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you're right that if we look at this as what is a fair return for Alaska's resources, then but sometimes I worry if people and even sometimes legislators feel that this is the best milking cow we have.
It is.
So to go at it when it's not necessary, but I think it's also saying we have broader concepts to look at. I for one, as you well know, feel that it's absolutely ridiculous to give, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars away and say we're poor and we're going to have to tax somebody. Now, that's a broader picture than perhaps the legislative point to hit. I think at the same time, when we get into what is a small thing, ELF, and spend so much time and energy or in saying that we're going to get another $10 million per year out of these magical new formulas, and then we don't look off the spin-off effects, how much production would be decreased, how many jobs would be decreased. You know, if we're going to get $10 million more in the L factor, How does that relate to pure jobs? Does that mean that 20 million jobs on the slope and the spin-off effects will be lost? Those are the important things to me, not only the fair amount that we get for our resources, but the spin-off effects of it, where the cost is.
Marco? Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because it's the first time I've heard it, I want to make sure that I heard it right. Do I understand that Mr. Nelson then is suggesting that the legislature should reimpose a personal income tax or impose a state sales tax before we do anything touching the health or the severance tax? Is that correct?
No, that's incorrect. If you read the latest issue of the Tundra Times, that you could see where I was quoted by saying just the opposite.
Well, could you run that, say it again?
When we looked at the broad base, we must look at everything. Mm-hmm. All we are is a committee to look at things. The legislature will decide what they think is the best thing to do with whatever is available. And all I'm saying is that tax should be looked at the same as what we're looking at in the severance taxes, the income taxes for the corporations, and everything else. That's all.
We're almost through the first option, Chuck.
Okay. Shall I move on to the second one, the
second
modified
option.
Formula?
Okay.
I think you received a fairly lengthy presentation last time, or a couple presentations on, or at least you've been through this thing before. To simplify it, the change in the formula for ELF really allows the specification of where the tax will go up and where it will go down. In the current bill, that trigger is set at field productivity of roughly 80,000 barrels a day. That is, if the field produces less than 80,000 barrels per day, the calculated ELF will be lower than is currently calculated. If the field produces more, the ELF will be higher, and hence the tax rate would be higher. The modification that was presented last time, that formula was changed so that the trigger for the quote, so-called, I would call it the large field or the small field tax break, went up to about 100,000 barrels a day. I guess the point I would make is that given the way this formula works, that number can be moved up or down. I think the analysis done to date has been strictly based on, assumptions about what it is thought would be produced from the so-called marginal fields in the North Slope. I think probably Endicott, Lisburn, primarily. The results we used in this analysis, we did use the formula specification, which puts the trigger at 100,000 barrels a day, and with the result that revenues over the 20-year period, well, it's less than that, actually, 87 through 2005, but increased by $2.2 billion in nominal dollar terms. If you discount those at 8%, it's just over $1 billion. Okay, as might be expected, because of the upside potential of the higher effective tax rate on the large fields, in those instances when oil prices grow, the state receives more revenue than it would under the current law. Because of the lower tax rates, though, on the marginal fields, the effect on production is somewhat mitigated, so that although revenues go up over the 20-some year, or less than 20 years, anyway, whatever you want to call it, period, the production, on average, we would expect the production to be negatively impacted by 28 million barrels. This alternative would, if we look at the result in terms of the number of barrels lost for every, or the other way around, the amount of money, increased revenues for every barrel foregone, we're looking at $80 a barrel. Okay. The next, and maybe I'll just continue on through the rest of the alternatives if we want to get back to any questions.
Okay.
Is that okay? The next alternative we looked at was the inflation adjusting the severance tax floor. We proposed to raise the floor to $1.50 and index it for inflation. This particular alternative results in an additional, over that same period of time through 2005, nominal dollars of $1.8 billion or 1.2 discounted 8%. But you do have a fairly dramatic negative effect on production. You lose roughly, well, on average, you would expect to lose right around, I think it's 170 million barrels. Okay, this impact is a direct result of the increased likelihood that such a tax would cause a premature shutdown in the already producing oil fields or would make additional investment uneconomic. The alternative has a most dramatic effect on Prudhoe Bay production because it significantly increases the probability that Prudhoe Bay would shut down prematurely. Now the reason for this is simply that with an indexed floor, that means that the severance tax has no relationship, let me put it this way, that you're eliminating the symmetry of the severance tax with profitability issue that was raised that last time. That is, the state does not share a loss in revenue when the companies share a loss in revenue due to low prices, but the state gets the high revenues when high prices occur. So the effect is that on average, then, going to this alternative, you are really going to potentially diminish the likelihood of, or the profitability of investment in enhanced recovery, or even in some cases of continuing to produce. In terms of our little criteria, the ratio of barrels, or of revenue to barrels lost, this would increase average expected revenues by roughly $10 for every barrel of production foregone. So, anyway, let me finally move to the last alternative. Maybe the easiest way, I guess, if you wanted to modify the ELF, would be to completely eliminate the idea of providing tax relief through the ELF mechanism and just get rid of it altogether. And, go away from the idea of a graduated severance tax. This alternative produces a lot of revenue, $5 billion over the through the year 2005. It also, or discounted $2 billion, but it also has a fairly large impact on average expected production. It would be estimated to fall by roughly 85 million barrels. I guess if we want to look at the ratio, this would amount to gaining $49 for every barrel of oil production foregone. Okay, let me just summarize, and then maybe we can address any questions. Yeah. All four of the proposed changes in the severance tax result on average in increased state revenues. Average expected oil production, however, is lower due to the negative impact of potentially higher taxes on expected profitability. The effect of each of these proposed changes is analyzed using the Monte Carlo simulation model. This type of model evaluates many possible combinations of variables affecting oil production revenues, including high prices where taxes are not so important in determining feasibility, and low prices where taxes may be an important consideration in deciding whether or not a project is viable. The output of the model is determined not only by the scenarios of prices, costs, and quantities entered as input, but also by the probability assigned to each scenario. The model results, in this case, state petroleum production revenue by year to the year 2000, are then depicted as a probability distribution of possible outcomes. Another way of looking at the output is to say many possible outcomes are evaluated, and this is what to expect on average will occur. The analysis is obviously only as good as the input, and we in the Department of Revenue have weighted the scenarios in-house, which this may or may not correspond to the way in which the different producing oil companies would weight them. Further, the feasibility part of the model uses a hurdle rate of 8% real and assumes no budget constraints and no competing global investment alternatives. But these caveats aside, let me summarize what the results are. Number one, fixing the severance tax floor at 80 cents per barrel has the least impact on expected state revenue and has the least negative impact on expected North Slope production. Number two, eliminating the ELF entirely generates the largest average expected increase in state revenue. Number three, increasing the fixed floor to $1.50 and indexing it to account for inflation has the greatest negative effect on average expected production. And number four, because the real upside potential for state revenue continues to depend on the share of the value of Prudhoe Bay production taken by the state, modifying the ELF to reflect total field productivity is the most efficient alternative in terms of dollars gained for every barrel foregone. In other words, for instance, $80 per barrel as opposed to $7 a barrel in the fixed 80 cent per barrel case. This is because this tax increases revenues while at the same time mitigating the negative effect on average expected production. And what the ranking of ELF alternatives using this type of revenue maximizing criteria is as follows. Number one, modified exponent, $80 a barrel. Number two, eliminate the ELF, $49 a barrel. Indexed floor, $10 a barrel. And last, the fixed 80 cent floor, $7 a barrel. And finally, number five, the production disincentives are generally associated with development of the so-called marginal fields and enhanced recovery investment in Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. Although in some very low price cases, no doubt potentially higher taxes cause even these already producing fields to be shut in. I've gone further in the analysis to talk a little bit about Cook Inlet because under all of these assumptions except for, I guess, the, well, arguably the fixed 80 cent floor, but certainly the modified ELF, in other words, eliminating the ELF and indexing a floor at $1.50 would probably shut those fields in. Part of the problem with evaluating Cook Inlet is that Cook Inlet is not a big oil field. It's a number of smaller oil fields, and currently all of those oil fields are very late in their productive lives. The well per well productivity is so low that in most cases none of the Cook Inlet oil produced today is paying much of any severance tax. I believe the ELF for the largest producing field, I looked it up in September or August, was something like 0.0041. So I guess you could ask the question, well, if we forced those fields to pay 80 cents a barrel, would they continue to operate? You're talking about the economics of abandonment, which is in the case of Cook Inlet, we're talking about some very expensive platforms. It's arguable whether or not they could continue to produce with that kind of a tax payment. I guess I would tend to argue they probably would, but he certainly wouldn't see any additional investment in the inlet as a result. That's a strictly subjective opinion. We have not specifically investigated the impact of these ELF proposals on Cook Inlet, but I guess that sort of summarizes what I would have to say about that. Now, I'd be willing to answer any questions about these alternatives or any of the issues with respect to the ELF at this time.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, thank you. One of the things that you mentioned to begin with was the federal
new tax law. And there's one, if you haven't done it yet, if perhaps we could have a scenario of the federal impact to say on the oil industry, not necessarily other things, but on the oil industry, and how that may impact Alaska as to a disincentive to invest in this state. It just seems to me that they lost their pants in Oklahoma.
Yes, we have evaluated the effect of the new tax law, federal income tax, corporate income tax, for the North Slope, and I can tell you that it has a pretty negative effect. It's, your rate of return is going to be lower. In fact, I have some numbers. We ran the average expected wellhead price through our feasibility model. And we estimate that between the year 1994 and 2014, we would expect nearly 450 million barrels a day less under this new tax regime.
450 million barrels a year.
Yes, a year.
A day.
No, that's the total. That's the total.
Oh, that's the total.
451 million a year. That's not much less than the current. But.
That's right.
Anyway, I'm sorry to make it. Between 1994 and 2014, because those are the years that we model as being the primary time period in which there would be major investments in Prudhoe Bay enhanced recovery. That's our estimate of the impact.
You think in the three options you gave us, is that familiar with the federal government face to face?
Yes.
About what we would lose here on the state level, does this include what you know about the federal?
Okay, this would be the federal tax code is part of the structure which I did this sensitivity. So the only thing that we varied was the severance tax. In other words, with the new tax law in effect, vary the severance tax, these are the effects. If you wanted to look, it makes it a little difficult to account for how much of the loss in production is due to the change in the state tax and the change in the federal tax, although you could compare, I guess, it's not an additive thing. You would not want to take 400, I guess what I'm trying to say is you would not want to take the 451 million barrels that we show for Prudhoe Bay, add those on to the numbers for each of these alternatives. Those have already been accounted. The new federal tax structure is in the structure that was used to evaluate each of these alternatives. Put another way, if we didn't have the new tax law, the both the base and the alternative evaluated would move up and down like this, see? So that the differences would stay the same. It would just be the base and the change. Is that
sure.
Good? Enough explanation?
Okay.
Thank you. Looking at option two, Chuck, does this proposal address the so-called trapdoor effect?
Let's see, that
in other words, in the option where you're modifying the exponent, in the event that prices were to fall very low, would we still have the potential of receiving no income from the severance tax if we were to make the modification in option two?
It will affect it, but because of the way the formula works, the effect. First of all, as you may recall from looking at the work that was done on the price sensitivity of the L, you really don't get price sensitive until price the well gets very low. In fact, I believe it doesn't make sense for the Prudhoe Bay producers to file for a redetermination of the PAL until the price gets down around $1.70 or so. I don't have, but that's a pretty low price. With the new formulation, that price would be even lower because the ELF value would stay high. Because if you look at the way the formula is constructed, basically the exponent is 47 million divided by 300 times 1.5 in the case of food, or 1,500,000. So that 300 number has to would have to change, would have to get very, very large in order for the elk herd to begin to fall. It would not totally prevent that the problem that you're talking about as far as the decoupling, but it would help it. Now, I don't have any, we have not run the scenarios to investigate how going to this modified L formula would affect that, you know, the price sensitivity of L. But that can be done as well.
And the wellhead today is about...
The wellhead today, I believe, is around, well, let's see. It's around $7, I believe, but I would have to verify that.
Seven on the north slope?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Let me check. Actually, it'd be closer to, yeah, it'd probably be closer to six. I'm trying to remember, I don't have the DNR September report, but it's somewhere around here. It's between 5 and 7.
Well, first and foremost, of course, with respect to the model. The model is only as good as the people that have put it together. They've had some very good people work on the model. But any model that you develop is not a perfect reflection of it, but regardless of whether it's a model like this or as far as simulation models or determining the reserves and the effect on different things that we see in the field. But the only thing that I see in here that all of my background in the oil industry and I have a background in the industry, as most people know, overseas in the large, very large, twice as large crude oil bay fields in Saudi Arabia. And then also in North Africa, as well as Venezuela, and you still have a difficulty. It's very difficult for me to believe that the production losses that's being shown here now, they've changed since the last time and have reduced even further. We've got to be careful. Is all I'm saying. It seems like to me that they're very low. They could be, and there should be some order of magnitude placed on it, because obviously, as it's shown here with the $1.50 escalated case, you're talking about losing $170 million, and the report reflects that would have a devastating effect, and I can assure you that it would. But even so, with the 80-cent floor, and last time it was about 40 million barrels, roughly 38 something, I can't remember, but the number has now gone down by about half. But say, even using that as an order of magnitude, you're looking at something in this nature right here of precluding the investment by a company to recover the reserves of a milling point, because milling is about in that 40 to 50 million barrel area. If we get into this area where we're talking about the elimination of ELF, we're talking, and the floor escalation, you're talking about a field that's half the size of Indica. Seal Island is out there now, as you well know, and it's more or less the size of Endicott, double what you're seeing here, and it's not being developed. So I think, you know, we need to be very careful in looking at these numbers and
saying, and then also to say that, you know, as we can increase the production that is lost, we can at the same time increase the revenue to the state, on, and that is true, but that also takes away, and quite well reflected by Mr. Lawson, that that takes away something, and in their model and in their considerations, they didn't reflect the competing non-Alaska project. That was one of the things out there. So that, you know, and it also, as he stated, I believe, too, says it does not reflect budget constraints. And, you know, we in the industry have budget constraints the same as the state does, and we have to have a certain amount of revenue also to cover our expenses and to also to make a return on our investment for the benefit of the shareholders. So I guess the biggest thing I can see from the previous report in this one, which are very similar, the numbers have changed somewhat into a smaller loss production area and increased revenues in one case and lower in another case, is the fact that I think if there is a problem, which I see would be that we need to carefully consider the number, a quantified number for lost production. It could be significantly greater. In other words, the 80-cent floor number, instead of being the 19 million, it was 40 before, reflects some of the things we're talking about here with models. You know, it could run anywhere from 20 to I don't know how much, at least 40 they had before and even more. And in our opinion, that would be something that's very significant. For instance, we did do just a look at it. We don't have the model in this shape at all, but one thing that this will impact is just future drilling alone. Future drilling alone, Prudhoe Bay, based on some of the things that are outlined in here, could cost us lost production on the equipment for drilling alone now, of what he's talking about with the 80-cent floor, some 40, now 19 million barrels. We looked at it, and it was more on an order of magnitude of about 30 to 35 million barrels. This will have a definite impact on additional conventional production maintenance projects, like right now we're considering, you know, a mid-field water flood project. There's going to be a definite impact on improved oil recovery, as Mr. Logston quite pointed out in what his remarks from the report, because of the fact that it's going to be much more expensive for us to come up with the technology to recover the remaining, after we recover the initial 10 billion barrels roughly, to come up with methods to produce the remaining, or what portion of the remaining 12 billion barrels that we can. It will cause premature shut-in, and we reached the economic limits earlier, and also there will be an additional loss of production, and I don't know whether that was put into the model or how, if it was, just because workovers, which we do sustain production with and are helped by ELF. Absolutely. It is a positive thing for the industry, because as the field declines, in order to maintain and try to restrain the percentage of decline at that point in the life of the field, one of the ways that we can do that is with workovers and stimulations, which are aided by the economic limit factor. So I think in looking at this, the committee should reflect on the fact that it's the numbers, and I think Mr. Logson would agree with that, are not precise and exact. They're an order of magnitude, and naturally, we would feel like, from our viewpoint, that they are quite low on the lost production standpoint. And also, again, I guess just being an oil man for 31 years, it kind of is a... I've never had a presentation in my life in the history of the oil business where somebody says if we can lose production, we're going to make money. And I can see it and I understand what he's saying here, but naturally from the industry's perspective, we're trying to recover every barrel that we can, and this is kind of a different approach.
Could I address that maybe?
Sure.
Because I think it revolves around, this is a forecast. And in a forecast, there are going to be some people that think price is going to be so high, it's not going to matter what the tax is. The project will look good. Okay? So you have to wait in a forecast. Well, what's the likelihood that prices are going to be that high? On the other hand, you have to look at the chances. Well, what if price is so low? This modeling technique attempts to do that, and that's how you get the result that seems counterintuitive to you. I should mention that we have prepared, in a Lotus format, a diskette, which contains, it doesn't contain the feasibility model. The diskette wouldn't be quite large enough for that, but it does contain the basic spreadsheet logic in Lotus, which forms the basis for our evaluating feasibility. It would look a little strange if you brought it up on the computer, because all it'll say is errors everywhere, because we've of course had to purge all the data from it, but the formulas are in there so that the analyst could plug in his own values and at least verify whether or not our model is technically deficient in evaluating whether or not production is. And if you would contact me perhaps after the, or maybe give me a business card or something, we could provide you with that. I might have to ask for a blank diskette given our budget constraints.
We can afford it.
Okay. Anyway, I wanted to mention that because I realize that by using the Monte Carlo model, although I've given seminars on it, how it works, and we've provided documentation several times to a number of people, it still remains a black box, and in large measure, you'll have to trust me. No. Getting a little. Yeah.
All right, check in the mail.
No, but basically, we'll attempt to provide you with. Well, we will provide you essentially with the basic logic. It's a deal. I think you pay vendors a lot more for these than you begin it from us.
I'm just beginning to figure out SuperCalc 3 from the last meeting, and now you want me to figure out Lotus to figure out the rest of it.
Well, we can put it into Lotus too, man. Yeah, we can. SuperCalc 3 will convert Lotus files.
Well, then this may answer a lot of the questions with respect to the model. That account for things that we don't understand. In other words, what was your basis for the production forecast and the well count? We don't know. There's a lot of reservoir engineering industry type things that affect the results of what you have here. And with all due respect, of course, naturally, we would feel like we were had a better idea of what those type of things would be to
right.
feed into the model.
We appreciate that.
I don't think that it's not an argument there. So that could, that could do affect the results quite a bit. And I can't remember. Did you say your model did reflect the rising cost of dollars per barrel for O&M costs and fixed cost? These are the type of things, I guess, when we get the tape, we can see how...
You would be able to input your assumptions on those, on any of those particular cost
but
items.
You had it in, you had some assumptions along those lines in the model. Yours.
We have ours,
okay.
But it's
okay.
Based on, as you realize probably better than anyone in this room, that the cost of production data is among the most sensitive data which that each individual oil company has, and of course we make our best shot at attempting to use both taxpayer input and what we see in the publicly available journals to put together these estimates. But as you well know, I mean, simulation models, no two engineers can seem to agree on a decline curve for any field, so it's we'd be quite appreciative of any input you can provide us on just those kinds of issues.
I'm sure you would. The only question I had, and you've answered, that you do have something in your model to reflect that. You use your numbers, and so all you're telling me it is there. So then it's just a matter of difference of assumptions between whoever's running
yes,
the model.
Yes, it should
you've
be.
Answered the question.
It should
that
be.
Was reflected in the
right.
model.
It should be. I think our model is a fairly conventional. I guess some people call them resource evaluation, some people call them performance economics. There are a number of discounted cash flow type analysis.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Stone, thank you. I think the two gentlemen are finally getting down to what I've been wanting for quite some time, and I realize the confidentiality of it also. Probably the Department of Revenue would give us the best shot. When you talk about production cost, you could well guess how much it costs to drill a hole to begin with, and then to maintain it over the year, so many people on a crew per ship and so on. So can we get an idea if we should suddenly switch from well to field, how many wells may shut down per year? Is that analyzed?
I can tell you truthfully that we make our estimates of capital investment. We do not that is an area of sophistication in terms of we do not build up our cost estimates from the wells on up. We use estimates of per dollar cost to bring on in terms of capital and estimated number of wells to come up with our capital expenses. We have made an attempt. I probably should bring the man who is most responsible for this model up here to talk to you more specifically about how it's designed. But let me put it this way: we don't build our costs from the ground up. Our cost information does not come from the ground up.
Because what I'm thinking of is a lot of times
I can't tell you how many wells will be, how many workovers will be canceled because the price of oil went down to $2 a barrel. I don't have that.
But to me, that's extremely important because they were really talking about the impact to the average citizen, job related. And that's what I would like to know. What will cost in the long run, not only what we gain, but how many citizens will be lost in jobs. To me, that's more important than the capital investment. When we mention capital investment, it's not always clear that you just mean machinery there or buildings. We don't get a relationship to human beings working.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not prepared to address the labor capital ratio on soil production. Obviously, the companies, when prices were high, the experience was that you could overbuild everything to be from what I read in the journals, of course, not having direct experience in the oil field, but there were an immense number of cost cutting moves undertaken, and it was discovered that you could operate the field at a much lower cost than was thought previously because you had to do it to retain profitability. So these kinds of changes in labor capital relationships are not something that are known until you get there. I mean, the companies, because they didn't have to worry about this sort of thing, may not have realized that they were operating at a less than maximum efficiency in terms of being on their long-run average cost curve. It takes real-world it's the response that industry has made to prices that's indicated just exactly what these cost relationships are. These things are dynamic. And unfortunately, we don't specifically consider the labor capital relationships in our.
But I think something that the state's going through too. Finally, we realize to be shipping up the large amounts of money that we may have to curtail spending. Just like the oil companies are trying to
being human beings, whether they're working within a state, federal, or local government, or private industry, when things seem to be on an economic boom, tend to be a little less diligent about trying to cut all costs, and when the potential revenues are cut, then the time seems to require it, it's done. So I think we all live within that type of an area. And there are certain things that can be done, as Mr. Logsdon has said, that lets us cut our costs in operating. And I think that we've seen that this year, both in our company and other companies within the state. But there's a point of diminishing returns there also, and the thing that we're looking at here again is the fact that the Prudhoe Bay field, being quite large, is going to continue to produce, and it would take a very devastating type of thing to happen for it not to. The thing that, with the current revenue situation within the state, is to be very careful about how we approach this, because this will affect the future. Not just today, and there's a shortfall here today in certain areas, and we had quite a shortfall this year as well. As I said before, every drop in a dollar barrel of oil everyone hears about the state, it's $150 million it costs the state. It costs Standard Oil Company alone $130 million. So we're very close to the state in that particular area. In the last several years here, we've spent, we the industry, not just we Standard, but we the industry, Standard has spent the majority of it, since we're the majority owner in the fields, but we've spent $5 billion invested. So, you know, a parallel, and Logsdon talked about worldwide effects, that I was there, I went through it, so I'm very familiar with it, that in about the 1959-60 time frame in Venezuela, they had a problem in the prices of oil and so forth, and some of the other things that happened, like they do in different areas and corporations and everything else, and countries have a revenue problem. They proceeded to tax the industry and even make it retroactive to the effect that it cost us $350 million in 1959 or $60. The industry then continued to produce there. We were making somewhere on the order of 4 million barrels a day. But the investment for future development and exploration stopped. That was 26 years ago. Today, Venezuela has not discovered a new major oil field. The money that was with the companies that was there. In fact, and I moved with the boom, and we went to Libya. The Libyan oil fields were discovered in 1964 time frame, 64-65, because the money that was not reinvested there because of this problem went to a different area. So all I'm trying to point out, and I'm trying to do it in a manner that is not threatening or all, it's just the facts of life. Just like if all of us in this room owned Prudhoe Bay and we had an opportunity to invest our money somewhere else, and it was much more attractive because of whatever the circumstances were where we locate right now, we would look at that opportunity very strongly, and because we would want a return for ourselves. And that's all I'm trying to say about the history of the oil industry. It works that way, and the potential, and we've said that many times, in Alaska is very great, greater than any place else on the North Slope, and greater there in certain areas than in any other part of the whole North American continent. But we don't want to feel because that potential is so high that the industry, regardless of what the costs are going to be, will just move ahead and do that anyway. And we have to bank that, and what he said is on future oil prices. We don't know what they're going to be. None of us forecast what happened in 1973. None of us forecast the drastic thing that happened to us this last year when the prices fell so dramatically. Everybody thought it was a price fall. So all I guess I'm saying from the industry viewpoint is to implore upon the members of the committee to reflect on this with all the information and not just look at it in a long-term picture, not just reflect on it as, we have a short need, and then if the prices go up, don't worry about this because everything will be taken care of, because it's also public information that not only ourselves but many of the other oil companies have stated that we feel like that the oil prices in the next 2 to 3 years are going to be running around in this $15 Arab-like crude rate, which then reflects back to about a $12 West Coast number. Now there's going to be some higher, there'll be some numbers lower, but the average is going to be in there. And all we're trying to say is we see it, that we're going to be trying to live in somewhere in the order of a $12 to $15 world here for a while. So we need to be very careful. And there is a lot of potential for a lot of marginal fields. And if something's done along these lines, they will go by the wayside. And there's one right there sitting there that's a very good example. We don't have to say that we don't know it's there like Anwar until we go, or if we're allowed to go there and to drill, is Seal Island. It's there. It's a 350 million barrel recoverable reserve field.
Following up on that comment, do you think that would be true even under a proposal like Option 2, where you're actually having a decrease in tax for smaller fields like Seal Island?
But that really, it depends. You see, when you say the lost production and what you have right there, it's going to reflect in a little bit of an advantage to the marginal fields of that nature, but at the same time, you got to remember that 12 billion barrels that's left in Prudhoe Bay is a marginal field. Now, it's 12 billion barrels, which is bigger than anything around in an area 20 miles wide and 40 miles long, but it's marginal because these are reserves that are going to be very difficult to recover. For example, a good correlation here is East Texas. East Texas is the only other super giant oil field ever discovered in the United States or the North American continent. Super giant is 5 billion barrels of recoverable oil or more. Prudhoe Bay is number one with about 10. East Texas originally was discovered in 1930, 5.7 billion barrels. In the interim period between 19, and it was the original life was same thing, about a 20-year life, which meant in about 1950s, more or less, 50-55, that field should be non-productive, and therefore all of the oil that could be recovered would be recovered. It's now 1986, 36 years later. That field is still producing somewhere on the order of 100,000 barrels a day from reserves that were not originally thought to be producible, because in the interim period the money was spent to develop the technology to recover that oil. We didn't do water flooding in 1940. I mean, this came with the time and the money that we the industry were able to gain from that. And all I'm trying to say is Prudhoe Bay, that other 12 billion barrels, is a marginal field. And that's going to mean something to the people in the state of Alaska. There probably won't be a one of us in this room that'll be alive when that happens. But on the other hand, it will happen, and I use the East Texas field as a corollary for that. So you must look at this, when you do this, in the perspective of the other 12 billion barrels in Prudhoe Bay and down the road. For instance, we have a pipeline, and without taps, we wouldn't be able to produce anything. Kuparuk is the second largest producing field in the United States, well, in the North American continent. North American continent. And without Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk could not have afforded the tap pipeline. So that makes a lot of other things available to us from these marginal fields. But down the road, there is not going to be anything that's going to come along, in my opinion, that's going to make us necessary to build another pipeline. That's 2 million barrels a day. When you get on the downside of the decline curves, the state produces those because they need that for your revenue forecasts, and I don't feel that we're that far apart on that at all. But as far as the decline and decline revenue to go with it, but in order to offset that, it's just like the company does, my company, the industry does, the state does the same or should do the same and say, what is the potential to offset this decline out here in revenue from the industry? And we are the largest industry. We understand it. We understand we'll be taxed more than the other industry because we are that. Okay. As long as it's a fair amount and we can get a return on our investment, and we will reinvest money, we'll continue to do that. But in order to fill that pipeline, or not fill it because we won't, in my opinion, be able to do that in the future, but in order to maintain as much production as we can in that pipeline, we are going to have to add these other fields down the road. So let's don't preclude that, is what I'm saying, by doing something very hasty just to cover the short term where we are right now. You talked about reinvestment. My company has reinvested, I don't have the other figure. I got from 1980 to 1984. We've been reinvested in the state of Alaska $8 billion. That's three times what we paid out in dividends. So, it's not like we and the other oil companies have done virtually the same thing. We've reinvested a lot of money into the state. Well, as a total amount of money, Standard as a company since 1977 has invested $12 billion. So it's not, we're here. We went out there and I may not last because I convinced them to build that building out there, but anyway, we had the attitude that we were here to stay, and it would be a shame, and we will be here with Prudhoe Bay, there's no doubt about that, but on the other hand, there's so much more potential here, and it's not only revenue for the state, Representative Martin said, I have to agree, irrespective of arguments about hiring situations, there are going to be jobs here. And not only that, that will provide other industries income who will have their families living here that are the associated industries that do work simply and solely for the oil industry. The workovers, the rig companies, the Halliburtons, the Schlumberjays of the world, and then all kinds of other businesses that have developed since we've been here that are local.
Well, I guess if we keep getting to this broader picture. I guess my question, maybe it's the revenue, or Vince, maybe you know the answer now. What is the share that Alaska is getting off the value of oil?
Sure.
I get real simple. Every barrel of oil that's sold, it used to be somewhere around 28-30% of that went to the state, and companies got 30-35%, and the feds took the rest. And that's varied up and down with the price of oil, with windfall profits and coming down. But today, where are we at on that? Is the state still getting its, what I consider a fair share percentage?
The state's still getting
about 30% then?
5%, I think ours is about, we're paying out something on the order of 36%. But, again, this year we're going to lose money for the first time because of the price.
With Mr. Chairman, I thought that we were going to increase now that the windfalls have decreased or stopped happening. And also, does this take into consideration all four aspects of our revenues from the industry? And I'm thinking just of the oil industry, seven, royalty, income tax, property tax. Does that take in all four aspects?
Right. And the state's share does increase over time based on our assumptions. In other words, the state's share of the pie and all of that based on the definition that we've used.
And that's taken in consideration severance, royalty, income, and property tax.
Well, I thought the severance is 15%, 12.5% royalty. I got to it backwards. And we have the income tax. It seems to me it should be about 33. I'm not an expert, but I'm just guessing over the place with the courts we have. Taking in all four aspects of taxes revenue from the oil industry. Severance, royalty, income, and property. I thought we were much higher than 27, especially since windfalls are out. We're not competing to the point that we used to with the higher price of federal government. Maybe we should have a review on that so it's a better understanding of what is fairness.
Yeah, well, based on our latest information, still roughly one-third, and I use the term roughly.
1/5, right,
please. And we will be coming out with several reports here before the end of the month.
Yeah, a question on that. I know that we original intention was to have at least 30 to minimum 48% of the revenues coming off from oil. Then when the windfall profits dropped, the federal government, which was getting, I believe, about 24-25%, dropped down to 18. Ours dropped to about 26%. The oil companies picked up the difference in loss between what the Fed were originally getting and what the state was getting. That was the last figures that I saw about 7 months ago. Now, the name of the publication, I can't recall right now, but we definitely dropped a couple of percent. And we're beyond the range that the Hammond administration set up between 28% and 30%. We're now down to the 26-27%. Now, when you say, well, roughly one-third, I don't know what they're originally talking about as being part of it. Now we're talking about property tax and other things. Was that originally part of the initial formula? Are we talking about the value of the oil itself or, you know, operational costs?
Okay, first, I think we're talking about two different reports. Of course, the different reports have different assumptions. The Department of Revenue, per se, has not delved into what the federal share is. We have stayed away from that because we do have to have repealed the so-called federal tax returns, and that requires a lot of time to get that information. But the analysis that we did, I believe back in October 8th, indicated at that time, comparing separate county versus a modified enforcement approach, and taking into consideration property tax, royalties, other factors, that the state's share, I believe about FY85, and I may be incorrect, but roughly 30%, 20%, somewhere in there, maybe lower. It varied from year to year. It was
85.
Up. Yeah, some years it was down. In fact, I think the range was roughly 26 to 30% for the years 82 through 85. After that period, based on assumptions, the conclusion was reached the state's so-called share of the pie, depending on how you define it. In fact, we defined it in two different modes, increased over time. Now, all this information is currently being updated because we're having to incorporate a whole array of price scenarios and also the new federal tax law. And the update should be out by the end of this month. Keep in mind, too, that that October study was based on a specified forecast, a certain price level. Of course, prices have dropped dramatically since then. This latest forecast, what we are attempting to do, or the latest study, I should say, analyze a whole array of prices. In other words, well-hidden values ranging from $1 to $25. That is necessary because of each well-hidden value
the economic feasibility for every field, for every year, changes somewhat. And so what you are going to receive here shortly is an answer to the question that's been kicked around for some time now. What point would separate counting be more beneficial than a modified portion approach, or what point would a modified portion approach be more beneficial than a separate counting?
Well, I'm not talking about separate counting. I'm talking about percentages and not the bottom line. If everybody has the same problem, they still would be getting roughly the same percentages. I maintain that the state is not, and that the difference that occurred when the federal government, dropped their tax structure, the windfalls, that fell to the oil companies, and the state dropped back as well. I'm going to have to dig that out, because my concern is that in this state, the Department of Revenue handles all basically revenue questions, every tax, corporate, everything else.